RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Anthony Powell has been at the forefront of creating innovative costume designs for theatre and film production for over 40 years, earning him an array of prestigious awards, including a remarkable trio of Oscars for his work on Travels with My Aunt, Death on the Nile, and Roman Polanski's Tess. At the heart of his work is a close collaboration with many leading actors for whom he plays an important role in helping to shape the characters they play, and his costumes support a sense of reality and truthfulness in their performances. He is known for his immaculate attention to detail, and the costumes sported by the cast in Death on the Nile became characters in their own right, as did the outrageous wardrobe for Glenn Close as Cruella de Vil in 101 and 102 Dalmatians. And again recently we have seen his exquisite sense of perfection in the costumes for the film Miss Potter. I spoke to him at the RSA in London.
Anthony, I'd like to start at the best place, which is the beginning. And the thing that intrigued me, and it seems to be the major kind of thread that connects all these things, is the fact that as a very young boy, you were fascinated by marionettes, puppets, and you made you made your own puppets.
Yes,
and
yes.
And from what I understand, actually went out with them on
that's right,
set on
that's
tour.
Right.
I found that.
No.
Tell me
tour.
A little bit about that.
Well, the mystery to me is how I knew about theatre and shows and things like that, because I suppose when I was about, I think it might have been something somebody gave me as a Christmas present. I'd certainly never been, because it was during the war, and I'd never, my father had just died, we were living with my grandparents, and I'd certainly never been to the theatre or seen a show, but I think somebody gave me a little model theatre, which I just fell in love with. And then from then on it developed and I started making puppets. And so by the time I left school, by this time we'd moved to Dublin, I used to do shows at sort of Masonic dinners and did one at the American Embassy at a party and all the rest of it with one of my school friends who helped me.
And you would have been what age?
Well, this was until I was about 18, I suppose.
Okay. And so you've been sort of perfecting those for several years, and presumably did you make the
oh everything yes
and the costumes
and the,
theater, and
the costumes and the sets and the oh everything so yes and wrote the plays and
really
yes
and wrote the plays as
yes.
well oh well that's well, I think that's creating a complete world then that's very interesting
yes
to do that.
It was
and then of course you
and then also just off. Designing, doing sets of set and costume designs for plays, just for my own pleasure.
And did your parents? You said your father died when
yes,
you were quite young.
Yes, my mother remarried.
Was there any creative traits in your parental background?
I think
background?
That my there was certainly nothing. I believe that my father was, who was a teacher, he taught modern languages, that he adored the theatre. I know that he and my mother used to go, they lived in Manchester, used to go to all of the first nights of new plays at the Opera House, and, you know, they saw all of the original productions of Mel Coward's plays, Private Lives, and also they were there at the original first night, which was quite interesting when I came to do those plays myself later. It was rather nice. But I mean, professionally, no.
But
I think he had a great interest in.
Because I think you were destined to go to Trinity.
Trinity College Dublin. I was educated in Dublin.
That's
and
right.
I actually got a sizeship in modern languages.
That's right, which you were not overly
I didn't want
happy
to do,
about.
No.
And so what happened then? How did you...
It was a complete fluke. My dear stepsister, who was older than I was, met this marvellous guy called Christopher West, who was the resident producer, or we'd say director now, at Covent Garden Opera House. And it's too complicated to explain how they met, but they sat next to each other at a reunion dinner of some kind. Neither of them knew each other. And somehow she started talking about me and said she had this young brother who wanted to be a theatre designer but was being pushed into something else. And this wonderful man said, well, I wouldn't. It's very, very dodgy. It's very difficult to earn a living. You know, many are called and few are chosen. But he said, tell him, if he's got a portfolio of work, tell him to send it to me. So I did. Huge portfolio. And I got back this wonderful letter. It was 4 handwritten foolscap pages, very small writing, giving the most detailed, and I mean, you know, I was 18 at the time, or perhaps less, perhaps 17, 18, criticism. And he didn't treat me as an amateur or as a schoolboy. He actually paid me the compliment of treating me as an equal, and gave this stringent criticism of, you know, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, you should never, this sort of colour doesn't work. In the end of it, he said, but I do think that you ought to follow it up and do this rather than the, you know, the other thing, than the languages thing. But he said, this is my opinion. He said, a friend of mine is a woman called Janetta Cochran, who runs the theatre design department at what was then the Central School of Arts and Crafts, now Central St Martin's. And he said, that is the best place to train as a theatre designer, and she's now a friend of mine. So he said, I'll put your portfolio in the car, take it over and show her. And then I got this letter saying that she'd accepted me, you know, that she would accept me as a student.
And was that design education interrupted by national service?
No, I decided that I'd rather, because at that time, I think the situation was, because I was living abroad, I mean, yes. I was British, I had a British passport, yes. But I'd lived for the last 10, 12 years in Ireland. So I could come over and I could study for 3 years, and then I could work and live in England for 2 years after that, without, and then I would have to do national service. And I thought, well, that's not a good idea, trying to start a career and then having a 2 year break. So I'd rather get it over with before I start. So I went to register for the National Service, and I was told that I actually, because I lived in Dublin, actually couldn't do it. So, at that point, I explained to them why I wanted to get it out of the way, and that I was going to come and live in England. They said, no, you can't. So what I did was I went back to another centre and gave a false address.
In the UK.
It was a real address. It was an uncle's address and started again. So I was called up. And it had a very funny repercussion because I was 6 months up at Catterick Camp and there was a terrible time in the 50s, with problems with the IRA, raiding military establishments.
Right.
And so after I'd been there for several months, the colonel and his staff did a spot check of the barrack rooms whilst we were all out on parade, and they found a rifle in my bedside locker, because I was just about to go on guard duty, and we'd all discovered a way of when you went on guard duty, one of the things they gave you a rifle, but which had been thrown into an oil pit and then into a sand pit, so that it was filthy and covered in dirt and sand and all the rest of it. And you had to spend weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks pulling it through and polishing it, till there wasn't one grain of sand left on it. And we found a way of circumventing this. It was a flaw in the organisation. And so we used to pass them from one, somebody had been on guard duty, they'd pass it to a mate.
Oh, I see.
Who was about to go on guard duty. And so that was what I'd done. So I was court-martialed, and then they just came out, of course, that I lived in Dublin. So I made it even worse.
Yeah.
But the story was so unlikely in the end. And also, I think I was being trained as a wireless operator. They said that my training had already cost so much money that they believed the story because it was so unlikely.
And you ended up in Germany, didn't
you? In Germany,
you were in one of the zones.
I was in Münster.
That's right.
Yes.
But I take it that none of your kind of creative yearnings were fulfilled at all in the whilst in the services?
Well, strangely enough, they were, because in Munster there was a club called Die Brücke, which was an Anglo-German cultural thing who used to put on plays. So I then became very involved in that and acted in the plays and designed and all the rest of it. And so half the people German, half were British.
Yes.
And curiously, one of the people that was very much involved was the head of British Army of Occupation of the Rhine, who was a wonderful man called General Hackett. He was Field Marshal, I think, then Hackett, John Hackett, who when he retired became the Vice Chancellor of London University. Very cultivated, interesting man. And so I met him there socially, and we were all in civilian clothes, and it was as though the army almost didn't exist.
Yeah.
And he was a demon with wireless operators. I was a wireless operator, but the worst in the world, absolutely the most incompetent. But there was, at that time, there was something apparently about my voice that carried hundreds of miles further than anybody else. So there I was, a wireless operator. And he never kept a wireless operator for more than 7 or 10 days. They just didn't please him at all. And so my colonel realised that we knew each other socially, and he thought, well, if I put Signalman Powell, you know, in there, the general has such beautiful manners that he won't fire him straight away. He may last even 2 or 3 weeks, you know. So I was Hackett's wireless operator, and he was too polite to fire me, although he should have done.
And then
I just very, very quickly, we were on every year they had a sort of big manoeuvres where all of the forces in Europe, I mean the Americans, British, French, Germans, Russian, were involved, and it was like real war.
Mm.
It went on for about a month. And so there we were on the road with General Hackett in the jeep at the front, me sitting in the back reading the map, and I think it was about a 7 mile long sort of cavalcade of marching soldiers and armoured cars and tanks and wireless vehicles and all behind us. So when we turned right, they all 7 miles away turned right, and me doing the map reading, and suddenly we came up to these slit trenches with little men in sort of funny green uniforms and who started shooting at us, and I thought, gosh, you know, this is wonderful, it really is like real wartime. And then the windscreen shattered and I realised they were real bullets, and I had another quick look at the map, and I'd taken the whole British Army of the Occupation of the Rhine about 5 kilometres into the Russian zone. By mistake, I don't know how we got it. So it was a major international, it was almost the start.
Really? Oh.
They thought they were being invaded. Anyhow, that's the end of that.
And anyway, then you finish your national service, and you return, presumably, to...
Well, now, again, Christopher West, because I think I wasn't due to... I'd been called up probably in November, something or other like that, and so I was going to miss the beginning of term.
Mm.
And he wrote to the War Ministry and said, you know, explained that I'd got a place at the Central, and would they release me a month early or 6 weeks early, something which they very kindly did.
And so you then presumably moved to London.
So I moved to London then, yes.
And started your full-time course.
Yeah.
And at that time, was that a three-year course?
Three-year course,
three-year course.
It still is, I think. Sadly, I never met... Because by the time I'd moved to London, Christopher West had moved to do the same job at the Metropolitan Opera in New York.
So you never actually met?
We never actually met. We corresponded.
What a pity.
And I owe everything.
Yes, it seems a pivotal moment, that letter that you received.
Yes.
Giving you all those...
But the generosity of...
Yes. Well, it's lovely.
Of what he did was so moving, you know, and inspirational, really, you know.
So there you were at Central... left to create and dream and so forth. And what was the experience like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a very, very happy time. Wonderful staff in those days. Ralph Coltar was there, of course.
Yeah.
And people whose names probably mean nothing now to most people. but people who, you know, I'm so grateful to several of the staff because they literally changed my life. I mean, there was a woman called Ruth Keating, who had been an extremely successful designer in the 30s and 40s and 50s herself. And she really changed my life. She taught me, she opened windows and doors and made me aware of vistas that I simply hadn't realised existed. Mm. And I mean, every day I still think of her and I'm grateful to her. And another wonderful, inspired teacher called Geoffrey Long, who was a painter, who helped everybody who came through his hands. And then a marvellous painter who is still with us, and of course, can I remember his name? I think he's in his 90s now. Scottish, but again, who was life-changing in that he taught one not to be afraid of the sheet of white paper.
Mm. towards the end of that, did you start to reach out to pick up small freelance?
No, in fact, very naughtily, I'd done that right from the beginning.
So you have
not of designing. I mean,
no.
But of working for other people as assistants, other designers, but an awful lot of things like prop making and jewellery making and millinery and scene painting and all of that kind of thing.
I mean,
so that I actually missed out on an awful lot of, which was not good, of things like life drawing. And I mean, I would think I probably didn't spend, to be truthful, more than half my time actually at the college, that I was sneaking off doing other things, but it was kind of swings and roundabouts because
yeah.
It was an amazing experience, and it also gave me a technical base.
Yes.
So that when, you see, I think the trouble is now, it seems to me, with students now perhaps very often, is that, first of all, I think that an awful lot of them are actually much more inherently gifted than we were, to be truthful.
Mm.
I think that they're enormously gifted. I don't think they're always helped enough by the teaching they get.
Mm.
I think sometimes they're not as well taught as they, in certain cases, as they might be. But they all sort of want to be a star straight off. They want to leave college and go straight to Covent Garden and do huge operas and ballets, and they simply haven't got the experience. And
yeah.
The odds are that if they are, as they think, lucky enough to get a job like that, in fact, it isn't lucky at all. They quite often fall flat on their face.
Yes.
And it can take too much
responsibility.
Well, simply the lack of technical expertise.
Yes.
Whereas, for instance, the first time I worked in Hollywood, the formidable head cutter, a woman at Western Costume Company, who had been the head cutter at Molineux in Paris before the war, she later became one of my very, very dearest and closest friends, but she was pretty terrifying, did the most exquisite work. And she looked at one of the designs and she said, "But you've done something that's not makeable." She said, "You can't make what you've drawn is it can't be made." And I said, "Well, I think you probably can." I said, "Can I borrow your cutting scissors for a minute and some sheets of calico and some pins and things?" And I cut it for her on the stand, and I never heard another murmur from her.
So you gained her respect.
I gained her, and we became dear friends.
Yes,
my daughter.
So following your departure from Central, because I know later you actually went back and became a lecturer for...
Well, I was teaching there whilst I was still a student.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's rather unusual.
That's right, yes.
To be a student and a
lecturer. I know. Well, I think what it was that one of the evening classes was taken by somebody who then moved to America. It was somebody, and I'd done work for him, and he said, well... And they were stuck, and they had... I think it was a millinery. It was either millinery or props, or maybe both. And they thought, well... Anthony does it quite well already. Perhaps he could teach other people how to do it. And they took a risk because there was nobody else. And one day I had the humiliation, and I could do it, but I'd learnt through doing of it. I'd never been taught formally how to make hats or how to make jewellery or anything like that. So one of them, I went to hat shops, as there wasn't, and was caught by one of my students buying a book called Teach Yourself.
So
I think it's called winging it.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, and that you did. Proves to be very successful. So you were there until 1971 at Central lecturing.
Yes.
But in between that,
and then it just wasn't. I mean, it just wasn't possible because I was abroad all the time.
You were beginning to lock on.
Yes, I'd started doing films.
Yes. Well, let's just move out of your design educational background and go on to the John Gielgud production that you were involved with.
Well, now that was again. You see, I've been so lucky in my life by meeting the right people at the right time. And I hate to say it, but an awful lot does depend on luck. It really does. And some people are enormously gifted and just don't have the luck. It's an absolutely vital part. Yeah, I think it was in my first year as a student at the Central that a West End designer came to the school and was doing a play being directed by, it was a new Terence Rattigan play being directed by John Gielgud, and he simply wanted somebody to make the model sets.
Yeah.
His model sets. And I was quite good at that. And so three of us were sent to be interviewed by this guy. And he said that we all took our portfolios along. And he said, look, I don't have time to look at these at the moment. Can you all come back tomorrow and I'll tell you which one of you has got the job? So we all went back. And I'd got the job. And he said to me, oh, by the way, John Gielgud was here for dinner last night. And he looked through these, you know, the portfolios, and he looked through yours, and I think he's left a note for you inside. And of course, John Gielgud was the king of the British theatre at the time.
Yes.
And so I opened the portfolio, and there was this note saying, this charming note saying, dear Mr. Powell, I hope you'll forgive my looking through your portfolio, but I very much liked your work and hope that one day we might have the chance of working together. And I thought, well, you know, of course, I was completely blown away by this.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, of course, he doesn't mean that. He's just being kind. But nevertheless, what a generous, kind thing to do. And I've still got that note somewhere. I don't know where.
Yeah.
And I never actually met him. When we were doing the production, for one reason or another, our paths never crossed.
Really?
I was working at the designer's house most of the time, so it never, ever happened. Then I finished my course at the Central, worked up at the Oxford Playhouse, worked as assistant to other designers, had a small business making jewellery and headdresses and props and things like that for films and theatre. And then it must have been 5 years, maybe 6 years, after I'd left the Central and I'd been, you know, getting experience and earning a living doing all of these things, that I got a call from HM Tennant Limited, who were the biggest theatrical production company in the West End, saying that they were doing a production of an all-star production at the Haymarket Theatre of Sheridan School for Scandal, being directed by Sir John Gielgud. And they told him that they wanted either Cecil Beaton or Oliver Messel, who were there.
Who I'd worked with
as their assistant, yes.
Yeah.
They wanted one of them to design the production. And apparently, I was told that John said, John had a very short attention, not a short attention span, but he got bored terribly, terribly, terribly easily. Mm. And I'm told that he said, I'm so bored with Oliver and Cecil. He said, couldn't we have somebody new? And they said, well, like who? And this extraordinary man remembered back all this time of having seen my student portfolio. And they got me in to have a look at my current, you know, work and portfolio and all the rest of it. And I got the job.
Well,
and I think that's
tremendous.
I mean, the generosity having, you know, taking such a huge chance on.
And that earned you one of your early awards, a Tony Award.
Tony Award, and when it went to
New York.
Which
obviously really sort of helped to push you forward.
Well, it did and it didn't in a way. I think people think that awards do much more than they actually do.
Well, they can do the opposite, I know.
They can do the opposite, because I was out of work for a year and a half after.
Yes, well, that's
the Tony Awards.
That is true.
It was actually rather bad news.
I know that to be true, because sometimes when you win an award, everyone thinks you're busy.
That's right.
So they never bother to come.
And so they don't bother to come.
Or they think they're terribly expensive.
Even more. Even more.
But you, I mean, you...
But I mean, I would stress this to anybody that was contemplating a career doing what I'm doing, that it is full of the most terrible disappointments and hiatuses and all the rest of it, and that nobody should do it unless their passion... I mean, everybody said this to me at the beginning, and I ignored it, and I've sort of battled on, and I'm still here. But it is very important. I mean, it's not something to be undertaken lightly. You must be... care about it more than anything else in the world, to make these disappointments, to be able to bear them and put up with them and cope with them and deal with them. Because otherwise it would destroy you totally.
Mm. Well, let's go on to you being sort of embraced by Hollywood and the film world, because you...
Well, that came quite a bit later. That was... I had a lot of very bad experiences. What's now the English National Opera Company used to be functioning at South Wales. And I did quite a few productions there, which were just a nightmare, because every time they did too much work, far, far, far too much work, and so nothing was done in those days, nothing was done properly. And every time the curtain went up on the first night, I felt destroyed, because I'd started off with a vision of how the whole thing should be, and what I saw on stage bore no relation to my vision of what I'd started off with at all. Mm. It had been so diluted and altered and watered down, and the last time was a catastrophic production of Mozart's Il Serraglio, conducted by it doesn't matter, one of the most famous English conductors, with James Galway at that time playing the flute in the pit. This is before his career really
before
started.
The golden flute was pulled out.
That's right.
Yeah.
And at the end of it was a catastrophic thing. The stage manager was drunk, he hadn't fixed the scene, all the scenery fell down, he brought the curtain down 10 minutes early after in the last act, on top of everybody, and it was just a total fiasco, and I thought, I can't spend the rest of my life doing this. It was a succession of disasters. And I don't want to do it. I mean, it's the only thing I want to do, but I just can't. I can't spend the rest of my life trying to cope with these with never... If I got what I wanted and it turned out on stage looking like my original conception, then one could cope with all of the horrors of putting it on. But this way, it just isn't worth it. And so for quite a few, I mean, about a decade, really, I had consultancy jobs in industry.
Yes, I mean, actually, we'll touch on that, because I think you were, you did quite a lot of interior design, what one would call interior.
Well, I did, it was mainly, I was doing modern menswear.
That's right.
Which in the 60s was not uninteresting, really, because it was just the breakthrough. It was the Peacock Revolution.
Yes.
And
you were doing
sweaters.
Sweaters and sable.
Casual. Yes, that's right.
Because I remember those. I remember at the time in the 60s, around about that time, the ads that Sabre had.
That's right.
Which were by, I think, Terence Greer, the illustrator, used to.
Well, he did, and there was a terrible memory. Most of them were done by.
But they were quite
at the time
outstanding.
At the time they were very,
and it was that whole period of, as you say,
that's right,
macho men becoming sort of more aware of their
that's
physicality.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
The E-type genre.
But also, I mean, of the use of colour and all this. So it was in many ways it was an interesting, it was a very very interesting time to work. I mean, by the mids, by about sort of 66, 67, when the whole revolution thing was just the full, you know, the floodgates had opened, that we'd sit down to ICO to design new collections, and we'd say, what is the most outrageously impossible thing for a man to wear? You know, and we'd say, I don't know, pink satin trousers or black chiffon see-through shirts or whatever, and we'd make them and sell millions. So you know, you couldn't do anything that was too extreme.
No.
So that was kind of...
So that was a period of...
And a lot of those things were in the V&A.
So that was a kind of pure fashion design period.
Yes, absolutely. But I hated it because it was... You were up constantly against the constraints of, you know, the salesmen and... You know, British factories at that time just couldn't be bothered. They just didn't want to try. They'd all been... They were... You know, most of our stuff was made in factories up in the Midlands.
Yes.
Which were family ones, third, fourth generation. And most of those, in fact, without exception, I think, the owners were just content to coast along doing what they'd always done. And they just weren't interested in trying anything new. And so one would have... We were working 2 years ahead of time, which is a long time in fashion.
The lead time.
And in fact, for some reason, I had a... it was just a fluke, but I had an extraordinary extraordinary antennae for what was going to happen, you know, in the future. Mm-hmm. But we could never get the things made, and so people like Yves Saint Laurent would come out with something that would, everybody would say, revolutionary and wonderful. And you know, I'd actually thought of it before, and we just couldn't get it made.
Right.
So in the end, we went to Italy and China and places like that.
There's one thing that I want to backtrack to very quickly, and that is because we're actually sitting in the RSA.
Right.
You were one of the early winners of one of the RSA student design bursaries.
Yes, I was
in 1958.
Right.
Which I'd just like to touch on that because I'd like to know really what effect that had on you in terms of your future career path.
Right. It was one of the most... Well, I was incredibly lucky to get it. And looking back on it, I wish I could say that I felt I deserved it. I don't think I did. But I was lucky enough to get it. And it was a travel bursary of... I think, was it £500, something like that in those days? Which, of course, went much further then than it did now, than it would now. And I spent 3 months... I'd never travelled, never been abroad before at the age of, 23... I was 24 when I went. I'd never actually been abroad. And I went, I started off in Italy, then I went to Germany, and then I ended up in Paris. And it changed my life. Because in Italy, for instance, in Rome, the thing that, I think of the whole trip, the thing that I got most value from was the ancient architecture in Rome. And it gave me a whole new sense of what architecture was possible about, because it seemed to me that in the Forum, there remained things like the Baths of Caracalla and all those buildings. They had the most extraordinary quality of... It was the fact that the mass of the architecture, the building, seemed to me to be perfectly balanced with the space that surrounded it. I mean, rather like Cézanne's paintings, you know, where... The objects of the background have equal value. And this was something that I was completely unaware of and of the possibilities of that, because I think in England, basically, traditionally, our architecture is to enclose spaces and it's to shut out the horrible weather and the rain and all the rest of it. Yeah. So it's making little nests inside. And this was a completely... To me, revolutionary new idea. The ancient architecture was a revolutionary idea in what architecture could actually be. So you had these huge, huge masses of architecture that seemed to me to have no weight. They sort of floated and were perfectly balanced, it seemed to me, with the space, you know, with the air, the space surrounding them.
Yes.
And I've never forgotten that. But I mean, all of the things that I saw, the other thing. And I don't know whether it still exists or not, but in those days there was a thing called the International Theatre Institute, and I went to see them before I went on this trip. They gave me introductions to their affiliated organisations in other countries, and I went to see them in each country as soon as I arrived. And the kindness and the generosity was extraordinary. They said, you know, we understand why you're here, how can we help? what would you like to see, who would you like to meet. In every country I got free theatre seats for everything that I wanted to see. They would have arranged,
wow.
If I'd wanted to meet specific directors or designers, what they would have arranged that. They made it possible for me to go backstage in the Palladio's Teatro Olimpico, mm-hmm. in Vicenza,
mm-hmm.
And go down those false perspective, which normally mm-hmm. the public can't,
yes.
Can't go down. And in Paris, and also they weren't stuffy about it. I mean, in Paris they gave me a box at the Comédie Française. They also gave me a wonderful seat for Josephine Baker's farewell performance.
Oh, really? My goodness. You must have been getting
which was amazing.
At that time.
So, I mean, it was life-changing in every way one can. It made me aware of vistas again that I hadn't, that I was completely yeah. unaware of.
Well, I mean, it's good to know that bursary in a slightly different guise now.
I'm still so grateful to the RSA for that, because in many ways I've been living off that, the experience of that, ever since. You know, the things that yes. I and the experiences that I had there. Again, in Germany I knew, I say I'd never been abroad before, that's of course not true, because I did military service in Germany. But having the going to the theatre there and the opera, but also seeing all of the amazing Baroque and Rococo architecture, which, strangely enough, although Rococo is a French style, I think the full flowering of it, in fact, came in Bavaria, places like Schloss-Nymphenburg and so on, those wonderful, I think those, for me, those are the high points of of Rococo, although they're in Germany. But all of that, it's amazing how much I managed to
pile
to
in
3 months, actually.
And what I want to turn to now is really, I suppose, the main course of this interview, which is really what you've become most known for. Because you as we've discussed already, you've actually dipped into many areas, from fashion design to full production design. But you've won 3 Oscars for your work in the movies and for your costume.
Because in film, it's very difficult to it's very, very difficult to do both. I mean, occasionally people do and do it very successfully, to do sets and costumes, but I think it's only feasible if you delegate.
Yeah.
You have to have a big team of people who you trust totally, whose work you trust totally. It's just too much to control, the whole thing. And I'm very, very, very hands-on.
Yes.
And so I would only... I mean, there have been small projects that... No, in fact, if small projects had offered themselves that were feasible for one, I would love to have done that, but it's never happened or things have fallen through.
Well, and of course, many of the films that you've worked on through your career have been, quite epic. I mean...
Yes, yes.
We'll come to those in a moment. But it seems to me that, and there are 2 particular relationships within the film world that I want to touch on as well. But first of all, let's just briefly talk about the first Oscar that you won, which was for George Cukor's Troubles with My Aunt,
right,
in 1972.
Well, can I just backtrack a tiny bit? I think it might have been my second film. Again, so much of my life has been predicated by pure chance. The first film that I did, the producer was American but functioned from London. And after the film was finished, I was delivering some stuff to his office, and the director of his next picture was also in the office, and we got into conversation, a man called Robert Parrish. And he said... again, it was pure chance. He said, I'm off to Spain to do this picture. Would you... I know you've just got back from Spain doing a picture. It's quite an interesting story. Would you like to come and do it with me? And if I hadn't gone into the office, I'd come 10 minutes earlier or later.
I wouldn't have
met him, and I wouldn't have done that. And it was a low budget, nothing sort of film. But he was an extremely nice man, became a dear friend. And one night he said... There's a friend of mine who's probably the top production film production designer in the world here in Madrid, preparing a film for Sam Spiegel at the moment, and I think you ought to meet him because I think you like him very much, and it's somebody you ought to know. So we all had dinner together one night on top of a mountain outside Madrid, sitting on top of a mountain. I remember the sun going down. We were the only people in this little taverna. And it was John Box.
Yes.
And we just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and just clicked like that from the word, you know, from the word go. So I enjoyed it and I thought, gosh, this is somebody I really would just love to work with one day. Mm. But I'm sure it'll never happen. So Bob and I finished our film. I went back to London. And months and months and months later, my phone rang and it was John Box who... They'd just started shooting his project, which was a film about the Russian Revolution called Nicholas and Alexandra. And he said, I've got two questions. He said, first of all, he said, I don't know if you remember me, ho, 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 that we had dinner together in Madrid some months ago. He said, can you, first of all, would you be free to get on a plane this afternoon to come to Zagreb to shoot with... 5,000 extras tomorrow morning in period clothes. So I said, yeah, of course. Yes, you see. So I whizzed off and somehow we made it happen. And John was actually, they were shooting there for a month. It was a big revolutionary scene. And he was actually directing.
John was
directing those second units.
Oh, scenes. Yes, okay.
And we just had such a wonderfully... I mean, both on a human level and a professional level. I mean, it just clicked, and you know, I adored him, and we did terrific work, I think. And at the end of it, he said, "Look, would you be interested in coming back to Spain and doing the rest of the film with me?" It was so big. I mean, I think I can't remember how many costumes there were. Probably, I mean, I'd like to say 200,000, I mean, because of the huge battle scenes.
Wow.
And all. No, it was so big that it was divided between four designers.
Yes. Yes.
He took me back to do. I got the job because, in fact, somebody had been fired.
Right.
And it was the person who was doing all the revolutionary sequences. But so I went back with John. We did finished off the film together. Meanwhile, one of the other designers was fired, so I took over another bit of the film as well, the royal sort of family. And all the rest of the work that hadn't been done on that. So that was a wonderful, thrilling experience. And that was my first sort of big time film. Then after that, John was asked to do Graham Greene's Travels with My Aunt.
Yes.
With George Cukor, the Hollywood legendary,
legendary
director. And MGM had said to George Cukor, right, we would like to use... At that time, Catherine Hepburn was playing the lead. And MGM had said, we would like to use either Irene Sharaf, who was the great star Hollywood designer of the time, or Pierre Balmain in Paris. Because I think he'd done clothes for Kate Hepburn before, for the theatre. And John said, well, I've just been working with this kid... who I think this project would be right up his street. I think you ought to see him. And George Cukor, who was one of the most generous spirited people I've ever met, together with people like John Gielgud. And MGM said, no, you know, he's too inexperienced. We need a big name for this. And George Cukor said, well, look, we've employed John Box because he's the top production designer in the world. And if he feels so strongly about this kid, there's nothing lost. And why don't we get him over and see him? I mean, what is there to lose? So they shipped me over there, and George drove to the airport to meet me, picked me up at the airport. And again, we just hit it off like that. We were absolutely on the same... You know, on the same wavelength, we had the same terms. A huge age difference, of course. He was in his 70s then. But we had the same terms of reference, and he was... I just adored him. I mean, he was funny. He was, you know, Hungarian parentage. although he was born in the States, but very Hungarian temperament, with a temper that could just fire up at a moment's notice and then disappear just as quickly. Terribly funny. Terribly generous-spirited. I mean, he could be terribly funny about people and other people, but it was never cruel or unkind. It was witty and amusing, and it was just such fun working with him, and everybody adored him.
Well, it was obviously, you know, terrific success, that first experience of the film, because you win an Oscar, which must have been now you're an old hand at that, having had three.
The very first one,
I think, must have been...
He accepted it because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I was off in Jamaica doing Papillon.
Yeah.
And he accepted on my behalf and made this terribly funny speech. And well, of course, I mean, what everybody must realise, that it was really me that did it all.
So you were making Papillon with Dustin Hoffman,
yes,
and Steve McQueen,
yes,
and
yes.
I think that, you know, that that film, which had they all had a very raw feel to them, and most of the time they were, you know, they were sunburned, skin flaking, and these rough
mangrove swamps.
Yes, all that. I mean, it was
wrestling with
the clothes certainly played a very important part in that.
The thing that always amuses me is that I still was naive enough at that time. I would read the script and I knew how much they were being paid, which was phenomenal. Steve McQueen, he earned more, relatively speaking, than anybody does now. If you translate it in long terms. And so I read the script and I think, well, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Steve McQueen, there they are, this up to the eyeballs in a mangrove swamp, wrestling with crocodiles. I thought they're earning all that money. Never occurred to me for a minute that I'd be 6 feet behind, you know, with all of their costumes in the mangrove swamp. Not being paid millions.
I was going to ask you about that. Because I, you know, naively assumed that when you design the costumes for a film, they're made, and that's the end of the story.
You would not be there,
but you are often
absolutely
right there with.
Well, some people do
to change things.
I'm there every. Well, it's in life and self-interest, really, because I'm on the set every minute that they're shooting, because if you're not, something will go wrong.
Yeah.
And the whole, I mean, one of the pluses and minuses of film is that once it's on film, it's there forever.
Yeah.
And you can't change it now. There may be a happy accident and something happens, it's there forever, that's wonderful. It's much more likely that something terrible will happen, or the dresser will put the costume on wrongly or whatever, and that's there forever as well. And you have to be there every second of the time, because otherwise something will...
I think that, in Papillon, that kind of distressed look reoccurs later, which we'll come on to, but I just want to go on to the next... important film.
The director, Frank Schaffner of Papillon, was the director, that's how I got the job, was the director of Nicholas and Alexander.
Okay. But the very next film, that of course, for which you received your second Oscar, was Death on the Nile. Now, I remember that film when it was first released, and the thing that struck me about it was the costumes, because it was such an array of staggeringly sort of formal and opulent costumes, an array headed very much by was it Ustinov at that time, or was
Ustinov.
It was Ustinov,
yes, absolutely.
Ustinov with these spats and you know, meticulous, you know, that really defined that character for all that followed. I mean, everyone I think thinks back to that particular. I believe anyway when you see that now, but that obviously was in total contrast from this rough and ready.
Well, the thing is that I've always tried to, whenever it's possible. I mean, I think people have pictures of you sitting there with piles of scripts, saying, tossing them to the left or the right, saying, "Oh yes, I don't care for this one is bothered." It isn't like that at all. You get one script, if you're lucky, and just hope you like it. And that's what you do.
Yeah.
I suppose some people, some designers, my friend and colleague Sandy Powell probably is able to pick and choose. I've hoped that it will be as different as possible from whatever I've done before. I always try I don't like repeating, you know, repeating myself. So I try to do as wide a range of. I mean, you can't have much bigger contrast, for instance, you know, between Papillon, say, trudging through mangrove swamps in prison uniforms, and something like Cruella de Vil, or Death on the Nile. Yes. You know.
Well, I mean, then after you know that you receive your second Oscar, and obviously with receiving quite a lot of interest, you have this collaboration with, in my view, one of the great directors, Roman Polanski.
Oh, who, absolutely.
You know, is you know from such an early age. You know,
yes,
had such a vision.
Yeah,
and this was at the time, if I recall, that Polanski was and still is in exile in Europe. He had to leave the States because of all sorts of problems.
I think what a lot of, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think what a lot of people don't realise is that in fact he was born in Paris. His parents, who were both Polish, of course.
Yes,
Polish and Jewish, were living in Paris at the time.
That's right.
And I've never quite understood why I went back to Poland as the war started, which, of course, was catastrophic for them.
Yes.
But he was actually born in Paris, so he's always had a French passport.
Yes.
You know, he still lives there.
Yes, he does, yes. And that very first film was Tess, which is an absolutely wonderful film. I mean, it's you know, from a cinematic point of view. It was taking a period subject that, rather like Chinatown, shooting it in a very modern way, and I think that was very apparent,
you know,
the extreme close-ups.
Yeah,
and the,
yeah.
And again, the clothes in that were very... very beautiful, but very natural and flowing and earthy, and the main character.
Well, again, this is something that we haven't really touched on, but I think one of the most important things, particularly in film, and in theatre as well, but in particularly in film, is that the costumes, the clothes that people wear, should, in an ideal world, should become part of the actor's body.
Yes.
So that you're not really, they become part of the whole person, like a second skin, really.
Yes.
And it shouldn't look like an actor with a costume dressed up.
Yes.
So, I mean, that is true of everything. Even the most extreme stylized thing, still in principle, that still should become part of
that. I mean, a lot of actors who you know, have different ways of getting into their character, many will say that actually it's the moment they put the shoes on, or the moment they put the hat on.
Absolutely.
So they feel...
it gives them the clue.
They feel like the
character. Absolutely,
and become the character as they put more. And that's why I think a lot of... certainly a lot of method-trained actors, for example, will insist on having absolutely everything right. The underclothes.
Yes.
There's no modern... they have every single...
Well, I try to do that as well.
Which I think must get you into that place.
Yes.
Of reality,
it's a thing of reality. Absolutely.
To reveal that performance that is
because
believable.
Again, working, with, it's far more than just designing a costume that an actor will wear. I mean, for me, that person, we're trying to create somebody who has a past and a present and maybe a future as well.
Absolutely.
And it's terribly important to know where they come from.
Absolutely.
Because again, even with an incredibly stylized, unreal character like Cruella de Vil, I said to Ben Close, you know, I think, you know, where did this woman actually come from? She didn't just suddenly appear one day, fully fledged. She was a child, and she lived in a house with her parents. And what was that? And I said, I think probably she came from a military family, and her father was probably a general or a brigadier or something like that, perhaps in India.
And so then do you often help with the kind of backstory with
actors very
when you are
very very
I've
very
not
much.
Thought of that because I mean I know in the research
very
actors
much.
Will write their own, you know, their past and future and so forth. But it's interesting having you there because you can also talk about, you know, what they were wearing and
well,
kind of social...
No, but that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's much more important than doing the drawings and all
that's
this. That's the base. That's the basis. And if you talk to any good designers, they'll say exactly the same thing. That's what you start off from.
Yes.
And it actually, with Cruella de Vil, that actually... you know, when I said British in India and military background and all the rest of it, and I said, in fact, there's an English actress, you know, absolutely fabulous,
Yes, Jennifer Saunders.
No.
Yes, I know. We'll. What I'll do is edit this video.
Right. Point.
But it's Joanna Lumley.
Joanna Lumley.
Yes.
And I said,
yes,
Joanna Lumley. Yes. As far as I know, from what I read about her, she had this background, and her voice, and her accent, her British accent, seems to me absolutely right for Cruella de Vil.
Oh, really?
And so Glenn got all of the tapes and things.
Really?
So you're absolutely right. It's spot on. But it's interesting because, I mean, all of this stuff is actually more important in many ways than
well, that's something I... That's a dimension of the costume designer's craft that I hadn't covered. Of course,
it's terribly interesting. Terribly interesting.
With your... Going briefly back to your association with Roman Polanski, you went on to design for Pirates, his big extravaganza.
Right.
And then you know, another sort of complete contrast, you were responsible for Frantic, and which was a very Hitchcockian, almost sort of a homage to to him with, I was thinking of films like Marnie or North by Northwest.
Yes, it
had
that
kind, you know, the very formal dress, very master shots, very... The whole thing was shot in a very conventional way, it seemed to me.
Yes, almost.
In a studio-based way. You know.
I think it had that
complete contrast from Tess, which was a widescreen epic, beautifully shot, you know, sort of deep focus. But so tell me about just briefly about this. This association with Polanski, obviously,
he
works very well.
Again, he's my top favourite director to work with because we have this extraordinary. It is very, very extraordinary because as people, as human beings, we couldn't be more different. I mean, we have different tastes, we enjoy different ways of life, all the rest of it. But when it comes down to work, we have a sort of telepathy. That's most extraordinary. I can't explain it at all. And time and time again, he has picked up the phone, called me from Paris and said, look, I've got this new film project and, you know, I'd love you to do it. And in one sentence, he will give me his vision of the film. I mean, for instance, with the pirate film, he said, oh, I love the 17th century and all those huge wigs and big hats and, you know, and all the rest of it. And we never ever talked about it again. That was the only briefing that he gave me. And I knew exactly what he wanted for the whole film just from that.
Mm.
That was enough for me. It's very interesting. On period film, certainly, we really don't talk. I mean, on Tess, he's a very sort of instinctive person. I mean, we'd never met before. He called me and asked me to do tests. I went over to Paris. It was the middle of summer. He took me out very generously for a wonderful lunch at the Grand Cascade in the Bois de Boulogne,
mm-hmm.
one of the most elegant
mm-hmm.
places. And we ate out of doors, had this stupendous meal with champagne and all the rest of it. And we talked about everything except the film. We just talked and talked and talked. And I liked him very much indeed and found him very easy and responsive to talk to. And then he said, we've both eaten and drunk far too much. We should go back to my place and have a nap. So we went back to his place, and on one of the tables, there was a shard of pottery, and it was standing on a little mat. And he said, have you any idea what that is, where it comes from? And I looked at it, and I thought, well, it's obviously, I can tell from the days that it's very old. And it looks to me as though it's probably 16th century. And the decoration on this shard is Chinese influence, but not Chinese. So it's somewhere related to China, but not China. And so just taking a stab in the dark, I said, well, is it 16th century Thai? And it was. And a friend of his, who's an archaeologist, had dug it up and had given him this thing. And that was what got me the job.
Really? And you later went back to the theatre with him to do the Paris theatre production.
Oh, to do Amadeus. Oh, what a thrill that was. It was the most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful production. And I hadn't seen the London production. And in fact, I just worked with Ian McKellen, who before I started Amadeus, he was just going it was Ian McKellen's first film, actually. And after our film, he was going to New York to play in Amadeus in New York. And we'd become great chums on the film. So I was longing to go and see, A, the production of Amadeus, which everybody had said was so wonderful, and to see what Ian did in the part. Mm. And I thought, no, I really can't, because if it's as wonderful as everybody says it is, it'll make it impossible for me. If somebody's found the definitive solution, then I can't do it with Roman. It'll be too much of a block.
Yes.
So I can't go and see it until we've done ours. So we did ours, and then I went to Paris to see. Ian wasn't in it anymore by that time, and I felt there was just no comparison at all.
Mm.
I mean, Roman's was the most brilliant, dazzling production, and he'd done something very interesting. He'd rewritten the play, Peter Schaffer's play, which was a bit bold.
Absolutely, because it's a pretty brilliant play.
It was a really brilliant play. He'd reduced, there weren't as many characters, there were still a lot of characters, not as many. And he then had it translated into Polish, and he'd actually put it on in Warsaw.
Because he was in it as well.
He was in it. Yes. He played, both in Warsaw and in Paris, yes. He played Mozart.
Yes.
And in Paris, in Warsaw, it was put on in a wonderful little workers' theatre. Mm. And but the actor playing opposite him was one of those absolutely unpronounceable names, an elderly actor, but he was the kind of Laurence Olivier of Poland. And was the most extraordinary. Before, I don't speak Polish, and the first time I saw it, it was a moment of a thing, and he made me cry. Mm. This Polish actor, without knowing what he was saying, I don't know how you do that. So then I went back to see it the next night, and I thought, well, he's not going to catch me again like that, you see. And it did, it made me cry again. And every time I saw it, it made me cry at the same point, which is the magic of brilliant acting.
Absolutely. You know? Okay, I'm going to move on then to returning to the stage with Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard, which is interesting because, you know, reading about costume design, the name Edith Head crops up time yes. and time again. She must have yes. worked continuously from, you know, a very early age right through until
she started, I think, I mean, I would have to check the date, but my memory is it's something like 1931, 1932,
yes. I mean,
something like
that.
And she went on without stopping
and
until
doing sometimes
she died.
Four films a year.
Yes.
And,
yes.
But, of course, she was famous for the original Sunset Boulevard movie.
That's right.
And the Norma Desmond
right.
outfit.
So what was quite interesting about that was that, you know, it was set in if my memory serves me correctly, I think it's set in something like 1948, maybe 1949. And, in fact, if you watch the film, you know, she did, I think, an absolutely amazingly wonderful job on that. But Gloria Swanson was dressed in contemporary clothes. Mm. At the time, it was high fashion of 1948, because that was when it was shot. And it seemed to me now that we needed, with the time distance, that I just preferred to do it with a different approach, to do it as somebody who was rooted in the time when she was a great star in whatever it was, 1913, 1914, whatever, who still was interested in clothes and got Vogue magazine and all the rest of it, but was still governed really by the principles of the time when she was a star. I mean, this still happens with, it certainly happened in the past with great beauties, with famous beauties, people like Lady Diana Cooper,
yes.
who to the end of her life, she would go to Paris, if she was going to a grand ball, she would go to Paris to have Christian Dior make something for her, and he would do something that was of now. But because of her choice of materials and colours and shapes and the model that she'd chosen, there was always more than a hint of something that Molyneux might have done in the early 30s. Mm. And women, I think less so now probably, after the advent of Joan Collins, who has turned about, I'm not being funny about this, she single-handedly, I think, altered people's perception of age in women.
Mm-hmm.
And Maggie Smith once said that every actress in the world should go over 60, should go down on their knees to Joan Collins, which is an unexpected tribute. You know? But certainly before that, before this new move on, that, you know, women who had had a great success because they were beautiful or successful in their career or whatever, there tended to be a time when they felt themselves to be, at their peak, and then sort of stayed with that, really, in a way. And even if they were going, as I say, were having clothes made or going to a shop and buying things, would be drawn instinctively, without thinking about it, towards things that had an echo of that time. That goes with hair and it's in the same way that old ladies now, even now, you go out onto the street, you see old ladies who always wear hats, because in the 20s and 30s...
I think by the same token, I think success... obviously old ladies with hats, they're stuck in this particular moment.
Where a woman wouldn't have gone out without a hat.
You get pop stars who reach their peak in the 70s, and they have to stay in that look.
Absolutely.
So you're right,
that's a very, very, very good.
And they're kind of prisoners of their own success.
And
they cannot move out. Yes.
I know, and they look grotesque.
Absolutely, they look grotesque. But I think also the thing that I find interesting in all areas of design today.
Yes.
I'm sure it certainly touches in the world of fashion, and I'm sure it spills into the world of costume design. And that is the way in which so many styles have been reinterpreted.
Yes.
To such an extent that they're through their fourth generation of regurgitation, that nobody quite knows where the original or is even bothered to find out.
No, but in fact, you see, I think that clothes always have done reflect the economic conditions of the time, and the social conditions, and all the rest of it. And it seems to me we live in a time of chaos.
Yes, exactly. You can walk down the street and see A-line skirts, you can then see a punk, or you can see, sort of a rockabilly, or whatever you want to see, you can see it.
Because, if one's designing a film, there's a huge difference, if you're doing a 30s film, between, say, 1932 and 1934 or 1935.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an absolutely...
little increments of difference. Oh,
well, not even little. I mean, quite big. Or the difference between 1929 and 1930.
Yes.
You know. Whereas now, I think one would be very hard put to it to say what the look was 2 years ago.
Well, I think that's good. You know, because you get the books produced on decades, and you have look.
Yes.
I think when they come to this particular, the first part of the 21st century, the first decade, it's going to be very difficult to pinpoint. They'll have to reference.
It would be very interesting, terribly interesting to know, because the thing, I suppose it comes from the way that we were taught when we were students and when we were studying the history of costume, the evolution of costume. So evolution, not just in clothes, but I mean in every way, the evolution of civilizations has always fascinated me. And, for instance, with civilizations, if you think of the great civilizations from the past that we actually know about, and of course our knowledge of history is minuscule, in fact. You know, when you go to the desert and you see petrified forests that have been there, where the fallen trees that have turned into stone have been there for 60 million years, and you can touch them, they've turned into stone.
Yes.
It makes you realize that we can't really go much further back than what the Indus Valley and things like that, of a few thousand, 10,000 BC, something like that is about maximum.
Yes.
And of course there must have been many, many, many great civilizations, maybe now at the bottom of oceans because of the tilt of the axis of the of the world, or areas that are uninhabitable now that we know nothing about at all. So it's very, very limited, I think.
Yes.
But even with the civilizations that we know about, they've always seemed to me to have an absolutely organic rhythm. That they all seem to come from the Dark Ages, and then they work towards, becoming more sophisticated, more clever, more gifted, those are all the wrong words. But I mean, what usually happens is that they reach a plateau of excellence, which presumably in Europe, in Western civilization, was the Renaissance, where for about 100 years, or maximum 150 years, usually not as much as that everything is more or less in balance. And there's a harmony, and a rightness. And then human nature being what it is, everybody wants more perfection. And so they go, grab, 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 we want more perfection. Then you go into a Baroque period.
Mm.
And then you go into a period of decadence.
Yes.
And the period of decadence then slides over, eventually builds up to a point where the whole thing disintegrates and falls over the edge.
Yes.
And I have to say, and obviously if you're in the middle of one of those cycles, you can't pinpoint where you are in that
yes.
cycle exactly. But I have to say, it feels to me that we're in pretty much far on in the period of decadence, you know, with the falling over the edge bit
yes.
not that far off.
Yes. Right, well, I'm going
to... Sorry, that's nothing to do
no,
with...
No, 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 it's a very interesting area to move into. Mm. I'm going to just finish up with a few more recent films. I mean, I've just recently seen myself Miss Potter, which I think is a beautiful film in terms of its look and attention to detail. I think it seems to me to be a very classic Anthony Powell designed costume film. We've talked a little about the 101 and also you went on to do 102 Dalmatians and those extravagant costumes in that, which are fun and exuberant.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but you see, that was a case. You know, I've said that costumes shouldn't draw attention to themselves. But there are cases where that is actually part of the character
yes.
of the thing. Because when Glenn and I were working together on Sunset Boulevard when she was offered the job, mm. and she called me into her dressing room one night and said, I've just been off this job, would you design my clothes for that, you see?
That's interesting that you get, obviously an actress with some clout,
yes.
almost directly commissioning to do something, maybe before the
I think
director.
It's the only time it's
really?
The only time it's ever happened.
Yes. yes.
Because I think Disney really, really wanted her. So she realised that, you know, she was in a very strong position.
Yes.
Well, also, I mean, they could have said no.
Yes.
But that was how it happened. But when we started to work together, you know, I said, now, tell me, how do you see the character? Tell me your feelings about the character. And she said, I think it's the most chilling thing that anybody's ever said to me. She said, no, she said, you design all of the clothes and we'll make them. And we'll fit them and make them. And at the end, she said, I shall look in the mirror, she said, and then I shall know how to play the part. And I thought, well, thanks a lot.
That's good.
And then because if you get the wrong, if you, this is a very good instance, I think this is a very good point, that if you're persuading, because you feel it's the right way to go, an actor into a very extreme look. If you give them, and Cruella de Vil is a perfect example, but I mean pushing them really hard in a certain direction, if you get that wrong, they will give the wrong performance.
Mm.
They will look in the mirror and they will see a person who is not them, you know, who's somebody else,
mm.
and they will become that person and they will go out and present that person to the world. And if you've got it wrong, they'll get it wrong.
Yes.
So well, it's a big responsibility.
Very much so. And there's another bit of fun that you were involved with, which was the Avengers, which must have taken you back to your days working for Sabre on that period.
It was bang on that period. And of course, the interesting thing was that having been involved in fashion at that time, when it came to it, I couldn't remember anything about it. And I had to research it. I got a decade's worth of magazines.
Yes.
And just went through them. And what was interesting was that, first of all, there were so many things I'd totally, totally, totally forgotten. And the big surprise to me was all of us who were around and working in the 60s felt ourselves to be terribly thrusting and forward-looking and, you know, brave new adventure and all the rest of it. And I am, in retrospect, looking at it in retrospect, was absolutely unaware that it was a period, in fact, of tremendous innocence.
Mm.
And I realised how cynical the world has become since then. It was terribly, terribly innocent.
Mm. Yes, no, in fact.
And that had never occurred to me at all.
No.
It was quite a shock
yes.
going through all of these...
I just want to touch on at the end now something that never came to fruition, but nevertheless, I'm sure
was an interesting experience.
This is Nostromo, which is David Lean's film that he'd been working on for a long time, and of course he died, and so the film never happened. But you were working along with him for a couple of years.
Yes.
I just wanted to know a little bit about that and how that.
Well, David Lean was, I mean, it's been terribly interesting observing with great directors, you know, how differently they work. I mean, with Steven Spielberg, for instance, I always feel that he comes to the first production meeting and he shot the whole film in his head, and he knows exactly the whole line of the whole film. But he's very, very, very open, wonderfully open-minded. And if you come up with an idea for something that's not, bears no relation to what's written in the script, and he likes it, he'll rewrite the script. And so, for instance, the title sequence in, which one was it? I think it was Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones, and the Temple of Doom started in a Shanghai nightclub with his now wife, Kate Capshaw, as a nightclub singer, just singing a Cole Porter song. And I thought it could be more in, and this was just for the titles, as a background for the titles. And it seemed to me it might be amusing to expand this, and she had a little group of 6-10 chorus girls with her. I said, wouldn't it be fun if this were expanded into a kind of fantasy Busby Berkeley, sequence? Because, you know, it's just a title sequence. And it would be fun, and it would be fun for Kate to do. And it wouldn't destroy, it wouldn't cut across the storyline, you know, because again, the whole thing can then morph back into the, when we finish the titles, into the mind. And so, and I did some sketches and things. He said, great, well, you know, let's do it. Now, there aren't a lot of directors that would be as open-minded as that. Mm. The other one was, in a different way, was Robert Altman, who, he would use what was there. I mean, a scene would be written for High Summer in a field full of poppies and corn and what have you, and we'd arrive there to be under thick snow. And he'd say, fine, well, this is the reality. We'll rewrite the scene for snow and winter, you know. He was infinitely adaptable like that. And the thing that I always remember was one of the actors in the middle of the scene spilling coffee down his shirt, and Bob said, that's real life. This is what happens in real life. So you keep that shirt and you'll keep the coffee stain for the rest of the film. You know? But David Lean was exactly the opposite.
Yes.
That it took him, he worked terribly, terribly slowly. He wrote it seemed to me when he was writing the script, which was the first one was with Christopher Hampton, that it seemed to take about a week to write every comma. It really was a very torturous process.
Yeah.
But when he'd finalised the whole thing, it took a long time because he was shooting it in his head as he went, with every camera angle and all the rest of it. And at the end of the thing, the whole film in his mind had been shot. Mm. And at that point, nobody else could make a contribution.
No.
And he... something I always remembered and wrote in my diary, because I thought I'll forget if I don't write it down. And he said to me, wasn't talking about me, it was in relation to somebody else. And it was after he'd finished the script and some new person came in, whether it was a cameraman or what, I can't remember, and started proposing all kinds of new ideas. And David said to me privately after, he said, I can't bear it when people start getting creative.
In one of the most collaborative
fields. I know. But it was true.
I think
it
was Hitchcock true. Was the same, apparently.
Yes, I think so. No, exactly.
Storyboarded the whole film.
Storyboarded the whole process
of directing boring because it was already made.
Because it was already made in his head. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
But David was there, and I was lucky enough to have got in before he started writing the script. And because I had so much time, I found really the most amazing. Just extraordinary research. You know, the whole thing is the Conrad novel is set in a mythical South American country. And I found a book in the V&A, a 19th century book, was published in the 1880s, I think, about South America. And there were all these rather blurred little grey photographs in it. And there was one section that there were these dolls, these model wax figures in costume from some very obscure part of South America, I can't remember where it was, that looked like nothing I'd ever seen before. They said South America, but you couldn't say where in South America, and they were incredibly detailed. And in the book, it said that they were at the British Museum, and it gave an acquisition number for them. And this was in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote to the British Museum, and miraculously they came back to me, and they said, well, you're absolutely right. We checked our records. We do have these things. They've never been unpacked. They're still crated up from the person, you know, whoever in the 19th century who gave them to them. So they took me down to their store in the East End, and they got crowbars and things, and they opened it, and these figures were about so high and were just miraculous. I photographed them all, and David just loved them.
So what pity that it didn't happen.
But I found a lot of things,
available,
because I had so much time to prepare the thing, of really extraordinary things.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, you know, going through all these photographs that I'd taken of different things and saying, you know, if the film can even have a quarter of the look of what we've got here, then I'd be thrilled. Mm. And so at that stage, those were the things that sunk into his consciousness and were incorporated in the script and were there.
Yeah.
But if I'd come in at the end, it would have been
wouldn't have happened
at all. It wouldn't have happened.
So tell me, what's next on the horizon? Are you working on anything?
It's my only superstition.
Not to talk about
it. Is talk about things before.
Okay.
You laugh, actually, when you hear what one of them is. But
well, I won't press
it. It's something we've been talking about.
All right. Well, the last thing I want to end with is the purpose of these conversations really are aimed at students. And
yes,
many will be listening over the coming month and year. And really, I think it's any advice you might want to offer to a young student listening who dreams of being a costume designer, working in film or theatre. Which you've done so successfully for such a long time, and it is a tough business, and it is a business filled with disappointments. If there's anything, any advice you'd like to give?
Well, that's it, really. I think one of the other, in the theatre, it's not true in films. In theatre, it's very, very difficult, if almost impossible, not impossible, nothing is impossible, very difficult now for somebody simply to be a costume designer. Because most people now, it's largely a financial thing, you know, that designers are employed who do both.
Mm.
And I truly don't mean to sound ungenerous, but there aren't an awful lot of people who are equally good at both. They're either very good at sets and not so hot on the costume side. And so I think one sees a lot of things, particularly at the National Theatre, that sometimes aren't just as good as they should be.
Mm.
Saw something the other night that I just didn't think really.
So the two disciplines you see clearly separated?
Well, ideally they shouldn't.
They should.
I mean, we were taught to
do
both.
It. Yeah.
And it can work. I mean, somebody like John Napier, who's a genius in he was one of my students.
Really? And a royal designer, of course.
And a royal designer, yes, and a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
I mean, he does marvellous costumes, but there are certain areas that he knows are just not his bag, which is how I came to do Sunset Boulevard. He was doing the sets, and sort of elegant, stylish period clothes are not his forte.
Mm.
You know, he does, well, you know, Cats and Roller, you know, that Rose game. I mean, I couldn't do those. I mean, he's brilliant at that kind of thing. That's outside my orbit. So we had the great pleasure of, and then we did Hook together as well.
So any pearls of wisdom then for these young hopeful?
Well, I think we've sort of covered it. In a way, I think the main thing, I can't stress enough, and hate to sound negative, but it's only worth considering as a career if you're so passionate about it that you literally couldn't bear to do anything else, because it's just too tough otherwise. I mean, even if you are successful and you get work, it's still tough and full of disappointment. So if you're not totally committed, I really, really would strongly advise anybody to try and think of something, you know, something else. I mean, funnily enough, when I was teaching, still, we had one student that I could see just straight off was in the wrong, you know, wrong department, and he was difficult and truculent and would never accept anything that anybody said, which is fine if you're young and you're a student of questioning things, but it seemed to me completely closed to any input at all from anybody. And also the work wasn't, you know, wasn't wonderful. But I did feel that he did have a passion and I felt sure a talent in some other field of things. So I said to him one day, you know, I think you're in the wrong department, you're in the wrong job here, and I don't think we're helping you at all. And I'm not convinced in any way that you're cut out, you know, to be a designer. I think you should go, and it's not too late for you to go and try something else. I'm sure still in the theatre, but in another, you know, in another field. And this boy's name was Mike Lee.
I think on that note we'll end. Ashley Powell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.